I'm John Perry.
And I'm Liz Eyre.
And this is Selected Prose.
Hey, everybody. It's February 16th, 2021. We are still inside, still listening to and or creating podcasts to help pass the time. I am very excited about today's episode. Liz and I interviewed author Avner Landes. His upcoming book, Meiselman the Lean Years, is truly something special. It's hilarious. It's heartwarming. It's beautifully written. I think it's something any of us who are writers would probably dream of creating at some point in our lives. Meiselman is due in March, and it's coming from Tortoise Books. I've linked to them in the bio, so stay tuned. Make sure you get a copy upon release. As for Avner, he earned his MFA from Columbia University, and he presently works as a ghostwriter. He lives near Tel Aviv with his wife and his two kids, and believe it or not, Meiselman is his debut novel. So enjoy the episode, and if you enjoy our show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think. Here's Avner.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Chicago. My family's pretty, you know, long time Chicago family. So I definitely, I don't know what's home, but I think also, I don't know about you all, but like when I'm writing about place, it's very hard for me to write about places where I've recently lived. I really feel I need to kind of dial it back. And like, I think maybe now I can maybe write about New York. But I even think that would maybe be a challenge. I mean, even my new book, a lot of it's in Chicago, some of it's in Florida. I've never lived in Florida. Yeah, but it's hard. I think it's maybe like too fresh in your mind, the place, where then it makes it very hard to kind of bastardize it in fun mm-hmm. ways, because you like feel like it's wrong, you know, like I'm not really representing the place. And so I don't know about you all, but yeah, I find it really difficult to write about places where I've recently lived.
I definitely, I'm always curious about that, because like, you know, you had to leave before writing about Chicago, and you know, the famous like Joyce had to leave Dublin, but like in the MFA, when you went to Columbia, right? So, yeah. So that was why you're in the city. And yeah, I'm sure a lot of the people in your course tried to write about like New York City, present tense, yes, when you guys were living there. And I always find it extremely difficult for some reason to like, it almost feels, I don't know, it just feels weird. It feels too specific. I'm not sure what it is. But yeah, something about having to like find the right distance before you can.
Do you think people feel like a need to write about the place where they live because they feel they have to almost be commenting on their situation, where they are, this time that we're in now? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's in general, maybe people are always feel this like pull to write about the current moment. And mm-hmm. I don't think it ever works out, or it rarely works out, if we're being honest.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's a bunch of publishers right now who are like, please, no more COVID novels. I'm like, right. how have you already written your COVID novel? I mean,
yeah.
It's an interesting question, though, particularly in terms of COVID, because, you know, this is a threshold that we've passed as human beings at this point in history, from which there's really everything's changed, and everything will be sort of changed forever in our lifetimes. And so how it's a particularly pertinent question writing about the present moment now, because it means something very different to write about the past from this perspective. I feel bad for my friends that are finishing novels right now that they started before COVID, mm-hmm. because it's like it messed up their whole project, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Are you writing now? Are you writing about the present moment now?
Yeah, kind of writing about maybe some weird, more future, I guess, but it's not like futuristic in any way, but it's a bit of like an alternate history. Like Hillary became president. but I don't really talk about it that much. It's kind of like you would just sort of figure it out reading it. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I wonder if there are certain types of novels that will be more affected by COVID, you know, than other types of novels. Like, I even think the Trump stuff that people write is really weird, and I think it's really difficult to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you all feel that way, but.
I don't know. I muted that word on Twitter, I don't even know who's writing about Trump. But
that's smart.
What do you mean by Trump stuff that people are writing?
I think a lot of. I mean, I don't want to say all of it because there probably is some good stuff. But you know, people who are like writing about Trump or writing about this moment. I mean, again, it just maybe somewhat. Like we were even getting into it, like COVID, you know, what we think about this moment now in history is going to be radically different. Like even I think 5 years from now. And I think therefore we risk just really stating the obvious. And that becomes the problem. And especially with Trump, it's just, God, it's like,
yeah,
it's all the same crap. It's the same crap you hear everywhere else.
Yeah.
Like what did you read Topeka School?
No, but I think I think a couple of guests have already talked about it, so I think I'm wondering like if I should, but it's Ben Lerner, right? His new book.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really fantastic. I do really think it's a great, great book, but I mean, there's some Trump stuff at the end where it just, I don't know, feels like a bad turn. It just doesn't feel there's like some type of break that happens and it's like the reader becomes very aware of it. So I don't know. Go ahead.
Oh, it just seems like one of my least favorite things about Trump, beyond everything obviously fucking terrible about him, is just that he doesn't allow for a lot of nuance of discussion. It's like when something is so rigorously like hitting you over the head, bad and terrible, right. You just can't really talk about anything in a nuanced way. You know, you just have to be like, we need healthcare, like we need basic things, you know, and it's kind of sucks to just have to talk about these really basic human things.
Yeah, you can't get all conspiratorial DeLillo on a Trump move. You're like, no, he just bombed a public airport, and he's like, yeah, I did it, and there's nothing to understand about, you know, what occurred.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's nothing hidden beneath the surface. I like the point though of not becoming obvious, and I don't know what else there is to say about the guy or the last 4 years. And so it's interesting. Looking to the future, I think is interesting. We haven't really.
Yeah, I think Trump will be interesting at some point. Mm-hmm. I mean, or like our lives. I don't know if Trump will ever be interesting, but I think our lives during Trump will probably be really interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, my book takes place in 2004, you know, it's like shortly after 9/11. And even that, I mean, I definitely intended to touch on some of those topics in a way, but you got to be careful, you know. I mean, really, you don't want it to be overwhelming, I think, for the reader. I mean, at least also I wasn't really interested, like that's, I mean, I'm not interested in writing politics. I'm not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think some writers are. I think it's probably, I don't know, is it an issue you talk about in the MFA program, politics and writing politics?
I mean, I have very strong personal views about writing politics which I can kind of agree with you. I forget I think it was like Nabokov maybe, or Nabokov. He said something along the lines of like, writing fiction is art and writing political fiction is propaganda. Mm. I try to steer away from it personally. I know what you mean. You just don't want to start sounding like a sociologist.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, like my book kind of made my character more conservative. Just because, but then again, also like, I don't want him to be too conservative because then that kind of becomes like a political standpoint that you're, I don't know, either parroting. I think that's a huge problem also in fiction today. It's like, they'll put someone who's right wing and it's just a bad parody of that person. Yeah. It's something cautious of, I guess.
Yeah. So your book is called Miselman. Am I saying that right? Miselman, the Lean Years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what, can you tell us a bit about it and like kind of the genesis and the origin story behind this book?
Yeah, I guess I'll just start with like a brief, you know, kind of like a brief overview of the book. the book, like I said, it takes place in 2004. It takes place over the course of 1 week, and it's about a man named Meiselman, a 36-year-old events and programs coordinator at a local library in New Niles, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. And at the novel's outset, he suffers a series of humiliations. I would say minor humiliations that he sort of blows out of proportion. And he determines at that moment that he's going to unleash his aggression. And this becomes the underlying impulse for the novel. And nearly, I would say that everything kind of becomes a struggle, you know, of wills, and every encounter is seen as, you know, something he's either winning or losing. And every word that comes out of his mouth, every bodily gesture are calculated for the effects that they're going to have on the other person. And needless to say, this is a horrible project for him, this unleashing his aggression. And things go terribly wrong for him, and it really just leads to further alienation, I think. That's pretty much the book. I would say we really want to talk what the book's about. It's, I think, you know, what does it mean to be a victim, and what does it mean to be an aggressor? That's what I really see the book being about. You know, why do some people want to see themselves as the victim, and why are those people usually, you know, the biggest aggressors? Yeah, that's the book in a nutshell.
That's interesting. And I was thinking about approaching the book maybe by looking at these epigraphs you have at the beginning. I love epigraphs. And the first one makes a tremendous amount of sense in terms of what you were saying, which is, it says, "I'll show them they can't make small of me," from Frank Norris's McTeague. And, you know, that's obviously really related to everything you were just talking about. But then your second epigraph is from Earl Weaver about baseball. And it says, "In baseball, you can't kill the clock. You've got to give the other man his chance. That's why this is the greatest game." Could you expand on that second quote and why you chose that as your second epigraph, and in terms of what you were just talking about the themes of the book?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to talk about that. You know, I kind of in my mind, I have this like fantasy that when people will discuss this book, they're going to, you know, so the way the book is set up is that really, you know, Meiselman's created this project for himself, that this is going to be the week where he unleashes his aggression. And he's set up this event that's going to happen at the end of the week, where he's going to be hosting this semi-famous writer at the library for an event. And this semi-famous writer, Schenkenberg, Meiselman feels that he's humiliated him, or he's led to his humiliation at the beginning of the book. And now is going to be kind of Meiselman's time to come out on top. And I think one of the things I like to think that people will have the question, well, is this really like just 1 week in Meiselman's life where he says, X and X, you know, 1 week from now, I have this debate coming up and this is going to be the moment? Or, you know, does he have this happening, you know, every week? And I think that's probably, I mean, that's a question I haven't really answered yet, but I think it's really the latter, you know, which is something we all do. We all identify these moments, these minor moments in our life. You know, it could be, you know, the next time I talk to my dad, I'm going to tell him that he can't talk to me that way. Or, you know, the next time, you know, that person calls me and they drone on and on and on, I'm going to just hang up the phone. I'm going to tell them I have to go. And I think that's what we do. We kind of identify these moments that represent these, you know, greater struggles in our life. And, you know, what happens? We usually fail, you know, I mean, that's usually what happens. And then the next day, you know, we feel that disappointment, you know, mm-hmm. We say, oh man, you know, I let myself down. And then that's it. We identify that next moment, you know, right away. And in our head, you know, we'll be gearing up for that moment in many ways. I mean, this is obviously on a much larger scale, but I kind of like to think that Meiselman operates that way. I think he's always kind of identifying that moment where he can just change his life. And I'm kind of Yeah, I think there is some movement, and I think there's in our own lives, I do think there's sometimes movement. I mean, I think sometimes we do come out ahead. I think sometimes we are able to get these small little victories that somehow, you know, push us in a better direction. I don't want to say self-improvement, but, you know, we get to know ourselves maybe a little more and not fall into those same mistakes. And then sometimes we regress. But yeah, that's kind of how I think of that, you know, that second, that Earl Weaver quote is that, you know, we always give ourselves that moment to right the ship and to get back in the game, I guess. Yeah.
It's so interesting in terms of, like, I love thinking about writing and baseball, and I know, like, a lot, I love baseball is the only sport that I like. And I even have, like, this picture you probably have seen of DeLillo and Paul Auster at this, like, and so I'm always trying to think about, like, writing and baseball. And what you were just saying was reminding me of, and I think I've told John this before, but in Murakami's book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Writing or Running?
Running.
It's a book about running. Yeah. And he, in that book, says that he decided to write a novel when he was, like, laying on the grass, watching this baseball game in Japan. And he saw this baseball player hit a home run. And it was, like, in that moment of seeing the home run take place that it was, like, this idea dropped into his head where he was like, I'm going to write a novel. And so it's an interesting way of thinking about both, like, you know, ideas that come to us or ideas that come to our characters or these moments that we spend our whole lives, like, maybe gearing up for, training for, whatever. And then it's in that singular instant, magical instant, that something great can happen, you know, but you never know. Mm-hmm. And some baseball games are so boring as a result, because it's just, like, great tension and then, you know, nothing happens. So yeah.
Well, like, I mean, I think one of the cool things about baseball is that you're kind of always, players are always, you know, falling back to their averages. You know, a player can be hot for 3 weeks, but then they're going to get cold for 3 weeks. And then, I mean, you look at a player's, let's say, lifetime stats, they're pretty consistent. And, like, they're pretty consistent then also if you, like, take into account age and stuff. And so, like, you know, in the peak of their career, they'll be like a 300 hitter with 35 home runs, and they'll do that for 4 years, and then they'll taper off. But they're going to taper off, like, pretty much the same amount as every other guy who hits that age. And but then, like, just like you said, like, you could even be a 220 hitter, and you can get up in the World Series and, you know, have that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, and you could be out of baseball literally the next spring. You know. So I guess I've always been a huge baseball fan. And I think I love the statistical element of the game. I've always loved that about baseball, that it's just a game of averages. And eventually you're going to hit your average, you know, which is kind of like life. I think you're always just going to hit, your average in life. No, I mean,
that's painfully true.
Yeah, I think, like, as writers, we kind of, you know, especially, like, I think when I was in an MFA program and early on, you kind of have these fantasies of what you're going to become, and then, you know, you realize it's so destructive in a certain sense of these fantasies, and that you're just going to be the person you are. You're going to be the writer that you were meant to be. And, you know, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. You know, that's a good thing, I think. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So something that I, you know,
MFAs,
I just started this week. I don't know about you, Liz, but I just started up the next semester. And one of our first lessons was Donald Bartlemy's The School. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's that really short escalation story in which a series of increasingly high stakes things die in a children's classroom and in schools and whatever. But, like, escalation is this principle that I think all stories have, but, like, Meiselman or stories like The School, where you kind of are, you know, you're working with that, like, original premise of aggression and like taking action in those small moments. But how do you keep escalating something like that through a novel to kind of keep yourself entertained and then, you know, hopefully your reader as well?
Well, that's a really good question. Yeah. And I was thinking, one lesson I learned from a teacher is that, you know, this idea of always turning the screw, you know, you really, and I always have that idea in my head, turn the screw, which, you know, the best way, the way it was described to me was, you know, you have a character who, you know, when something bad happens to, he said, you know, unfucking believable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the next time something bad happens to him, he says, unfucking believable. And then the third time, unfucking believable. Now, that's already, you know, the first time was maybe a little charming, you know, or maybe you have him say something even a little more interesting than unfucking believable. But no matter how interesting it is, by the second time, he says the same thing, third thing. I mean, in Bartleby, let's say it worked, you know, that's a brilliant story, but in generally it doesn't. And, you know, you always have to turn the screw. You have to take that language then to a new place the next time. And then the third time, take it to an even newer place. And I think when writing a novel, especially a long one, it's kind of the same thing. I mean, like in my book, for example, I have these breakfast scenes with the wife, and, you know, the first time it's kind of a more traditional breakfast scene. Now, if I had that in every single chapter, it's quite obvious, it would get, I think, pretty, it just wouldn't be that interesting. And I mean, these two characters are, that means like there's nothing happening between those two characters. So I don't think I'm like that aware of it, other than just something has to happen and not a lot. I guess maybe a different way to answer that question is that, you know, so if I'm thinking about like influences for this book, I really think of, let's say, I don't know if you've read like Stanley Elkins, The Dick Gibson Show.
I haven't. No.
Or Frog by Stephen Dixon. So these are kind of, these are just really long books that just kind of go on these crazy tangents, and like they're just moving like in and out of plot, and kind of like you could have like 50 pages before you get back into the plot. And that's kind of the book I wanted to write. I don't know if I really had the guts when it came time to really committing to that 100%, but I almost think of these books as like a little exhausting. Like these are the kind of novels I really like. I like novels that exhaust me. To a degree that sometimes I don't even finish them. I mean, you had asked me earlier before we got on what I'm reading now, and I'm reading A Fan's Notes by Exley. And that's also, that's like, I think, find it a very exhausting book. I mean, exhausting in the sense that like every sentence, you know, it's very hard to move from one sentence to the next. You know, there's so much in each sentence. You want to just keep reading it. You want to go back. And then also it just, you know, it's a punch to the gut, just what you're reading, that it's very hard. It's like I used to say, you can't binge watch The Wire. You know, you watch one episode, you can't then just go like, hey, I'm gonna put on another episode. It's like, and Fan's Notes and Dick Gibson Show, those kinds of books where you just kind of need to take these breaks and process it and think about it. So I don't know, like when I'm writing, if I'm thinking so much of like, how am I going to keep this plot going forward? Sure. I'm, like I said, I'm very aware of turning the screw and keeping it moving to a certain degree, but I'm also have the sense of, I just want that moment to be great. You know, I just really want that moment to be great. And even if the person stops reading after this moment, hey, at least they like this part of the book. And you know, if they can't take more of it, that's fine. I don't know. Like, I wonder sometimes if we put as part of like our like capitalist consumerist mindset, where we're just like, you got to finish the book, and then you have to tell people that you finished the book, and
you got to start on Goodreads,
start
share
on Goodreads,
it on Facebook,
and then tell them either it was the greatest book ever that you've ever read, or is the biggest piece of garbage, you know, like that. And I don't know. I just, that's not really how I read, and I I like to think that's not really how I write, that I just, yeah, I kind of work in these moments. I work in these scenes. I want it to be a great scene, tack that on to another great scene. And yeah, whatever you want to take away from the book, then that's it. I mean, I hope people read it until the end. I think it's a good ending. So
Not to put you too much on the spot, because I know this probably was a long project and everything, but like, speaking about scenes, do you have any in particular where you're, you know, you wrote it and you were like, you know, it's all right, but it's not great. You like, when did you know if you could use like one of the scenes in your book as an example that you were like, all right, I've turned the screw successfully, and what that felt like?
Yeah. I mean, the book's like whatever, 400 pages. I think I probably wrote close to 1,000 pages. So, you know, it ended up being a lot of cutting. And honestly, I think it's putting it in a drawer and then taking it out and just looking at the scene and saying, like, is this good or is it not good? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I think the one thing you learn, you know, I mean, one learns many things in writing programs or from writing classes or just from writing a lot. But the most important thing is to become as objective as possible about your work. And that's, I mean, as you know, that's the hardest thing in the world, is to be objective about your own work. And a lot of that just, again, comes from practice and from time. And a lot of it comes from putting it away for, you know, 6 months and then pulling it out. And like, there are still scenes I read that I laugh, you know, and I really enjoy reading them. And I think, wow, that, you know, that's good. That's funny. And a lot of those, the ones that didn't make the cut, were things that this is boring, you mm-hmm. know, it's not moving. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's funny to talk about that, the value of being able to see your work objectively in terms of humor, right? Because humor is one of those things where I'll write something that is funny and it'll be funny the first time that I write it or when the idea comes into my head, but then you really do have to put it away to know if it's funny, because it's impossible to, it's so easy to drain the humor from something, from reading it over and over again. And it was also interesting that you were mentioning like that you like books that really are like a bit of drudgery. And I like that challenge as well. But I'd say like, I mean, it seems like your book avoids that because you do write funny. Mm-hmm. And so I was just wondering, yeah, if you could talk about, I don't know, the process of writing humor or like humorous writers that you like or anything you learned from like writing long form humorous prose.
I anticipated this, you know. Yeah. Well, I anticipated that I'd be getting a lot of questions about humor and writing funny, and
I think Liz and I always come back to that within like in interviews. We're like, this was funny, how did you do that, like humor, like it's we want to figure out how it works, because it's the most charming part of, I think, a lot of these books and yours.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, you know, I think, you know, a lot, most, I don't know, say most great books, but certainly the ones I enjoy, they're funny on some level. I'm a big Coetzee fan, you know, J.M. Coetzee.
That's a funny writer to be like, he's funny, but he is funny.
No, I was going to say he's not funny at all. He's like the one writer. He's like literally, I actually think there's something kind of brilliant about him, because he is intentionally not funny, you know. Like, I think a lot of writers,
moments, but you're right. Yeah. Not very funny.
I mean, some books really are pretty, but he's really probably the only one. I think every other writer tries to be funny on some level or amusing. But I was thinking about this question. You know, I was thinking about humor and funny, and I started thinking about this guy I know who's not funny at all, but he loves to say, whenever you see him, he goes, "I got the funniest story for you." And you're like, well, you know, I mean, you know, it's not going to be funny, but then he starts telling you a story, and what is it? It's like a story of coincidence. And his sister's cousin was my doctor the next time I went to the hospital. And he'll say, "Isn't that the funniest thing you've ever heard?" And I'm like, you know, it's not funny. I mean, sometimes like coincidences are amusing, but I don't think they're funny. The same way, like, you know, I mean, we all know that person who's like the pun, you know, the pun guy who, you know, speaks in puns. And I don't think the pun guy is also, I don't think the pun guy is funny. You know, he's amusing, you know, sometimes the puns are, you know. And then I started to think, well, you know, what's really funny? And I think if you try to think about, like, when are you at your, like, when can you really laugh with people? It's usually the people you're probably closest to, your closest friends. And the reason is because, you know, humor is about vulnerability. And it's about I'm going to say something right now, and you're going to either think this is the funniest shit you ever heard, or you're going to think I'm like an asshole, or you're going to think I'm evil, or you're going to think, you know, that guy, he needs some serious help. And that's why you can really laugh with your friends, because your friends aren't going to judge you, and you can really say anything you want to your friends because you know it's a safe space for them. And it gets harder and harder. Like, for example, we could talk about this later, but like Twitter, I really don't like Twitter so much because I find it very difficult to be funny, because I'm just so scared of saying stuff, because I'm scared of being judged. And with my writing, I don't feel that way. So when I'm writing humor, of course you're aware of what's funny, but you're really, I think, aware of that vulnerability that, you know, people are going to, you know, some people are going to take this the right way, but some people are going to take it the way that I meant it to be, that it's supposed to be funny. And some people are going to say, like, this is some, you know, sick stuff, or this isn't funny. You know, you shouldn't be joking about these types of things. And that's really when you know you struck gold. You know, that's when you know you have a really solid scene. And I would, the things that made me really happy, like when I gave my wife my book to read, are the moments where she's like, oh my, you know, like rolling her eyes and being like, oh my, you're putting this in the book. And the moments where she kind of doesn't know to laugh, or really what her reaction should be. And I think that's the reaction you want from readers, because you don't want them just sitting, you know, guffawing through your book. You want them laughing, but you then want them that when they're done laughing, they're going to think like, well, that was pretty funny, but like, what does that mean? You know, what is happening here in this scene? Is it really funny, or is it kind of also sad? You know, is it both those things? I mean, again, going back to your friends the same way. I mean, I think you're most open to your friends when you can laugh with them. I mean, I don't tell my friends anything. You know, I'm a very private person in a certain sense. My relationships, a lot of them are one-sided. I don't share a lot of my personal stuff. I'm really like the listener in the relationship. But I reveal, I think, through humor, through story, funny stories I can tell them. That's where they catch, you know, get the sense of who I am and what's happening in my life. So
yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, humor always has to walk a line, right? Like, yeah, like whether it's vulnerability and being withholding at the same time, or being you know, loving and hateful at the same time, or whatever it is. Yeah, and that also, that uncomfortable, that super uncomfortable stuff is great too. When, like, I could imagine your wife reading certain passages and being like, oh my, no, this couldn't be in the world. You know, that's great.
Yeah. But you know, that's part of also, I think, we were talking before about, like, how do you know you struck on something you like and that you want to keep? And, you know, it has to entertain you first. I mean, and when you can sit there with the page and you can laugh and you can enjoy it, I mean, that's, to me, that's all that really matters. I think once you start worrying about what other people are going to find funny and what other people are going to think about it. When I write, I really don't think anyone's ever going to see it. Like, I have, you know, writers that I work with, they'll be like, I can't write that. I'm so scared. My mom's going to see it, or my dad's going to see it. And I'm like, no one's reading it right now. Like, literally no one's reading it right now. So don't worry about that. You know, don't worry about that now. So now that I'm like 4 weeks out of releasing my book, I'm like shitting, you know, because I'm like, oh wow, they're really gonna read this now, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you I'm kind of curious, since I think you're our only guest that has, no, I guess David Rice has his MFA as well, but I'm curious about how, were you working on Meiselman during your MFA program at Columbia, or
no, and that kind of goes into an interesting conversation. I mean, that kind of connects interest in an interesting way to the conversation of humor, because I'd been writing for you know, a bunch of years before I started my MFA, and I think I knew that I was kind of just stuck. I mean, I didn't have too big of a writing community, and my writing just wasn't going anywhere. And I was really kind of sticking to this like Raymond Carver style, minimalist Hemingway writing. I think back then when I started, that was, you know, that was he was the writer, or their beginning writers were imitating. And then when I showed it to the MFA, that was Dennis Johnson and George Saunders. I don't know who are they imitating now still?
Not Dennis Johnson, but I do hear a lot of Saunders talk, everybody, you know.
Yeah. So I was, you know, writing these minimalist pieces, and you know, like even the humor, I think it was like kind of like this almost puckish humor of me being like more my narrators or my protagonists being kind of like the smart asses, smarter than everyone. Mr. has his life together, and everyone else, you know, are a bunch of, you know, idiots.
Yeah,
and,
they'll never understand.
Yeah, you know, and that was the humor, and people thought it was funny. And you know, I think it's very easy to laugh at that stuff, to be honest. I mean, one reads a lot of fiction like that in this day and age, and always. I mean, it's very easy to kind of make crap out of other people, right? I mean, we have a whole culture kind of devoted to that, of just making crap out of helpless people or people, you know, who are limited in some way. And I think in my writing, I was doing that, and people liked it. Oh, you know, it's funny and this and that, but I didn't really, then I started doing my MFA. And again, I was writing these stories, you know, this minimalist prose. And I think it was very safe for me, because like, oh, if I write correctly and I write these, you know, I don't take too many chances, I just write the story, get it down, make it a little funny, then people aren't going to tear me apart. And I was also coming from Israel, so I felt like I needed to make it a little political. I felt like people expected that I'm going to have like these political, going back even to what we were talking about at the beginning, I need to have this political message, but it has to be the right type of political message. And, you know, I was enjoying my time in the MFA, you know, I was learning stuff, but I would say for almost the first year and a half, I really wasn't enjoying my writing. I mean, I would write these stories and they'd feel somewhat competent, but they weren't, like, I wasn't excited about them. I wasn't reading them later and being like, that was great. You know, I would leave workshop. We'd critique my story and people would be like, oh, you know, it's fine. Work on this, work on that. And I would just take it and I put it in a drawer. I had no interest in looking at it again. No interest in working on it. And then, you know, one night I just kind of was up really late at night, and I don't really remember what it was exactly. Like, my mom, I guess a week earlier, like, mentioned that the next door neighbors were selling their house, and wouldn't it be great if one of her kids could buy the house and live next door to her?
What a mom comment.
And and I don't know, I sat down to write, and I just started writing about some, you know, guy who lives next door to his parents, you know, some married guy who lives next door to his parents. And just like the prose that came out that night was really different. Like, I knew right away, like, I felt it. Like, it just felt really different. You know, it had that rhythm that I think was missing from everything else I had written before that. I wasn't even thinking in those terms of rhythm. Sure, it was a thing that I noticed in other writers, but I didn't really know what it meant to bring that to my own writing, where you feel like one sentence, you know, like even the rhythm in one, of one sentence connecting to the rhythm of the next sentence. And, you know, I handed that in for workshop. I submitted it for workshop, like the first chapter. And even like my workshop instructor at the time was like, I remember she wrote in the beginning of her comments, like, wow. And I don't even think the pages were that necessarily great. I mean, they're, you know, they're all sorts of problems, but it was definitely that awareness of like, wow, you've really done something different here. You've really done something different here. And and that's how I started the book. And then I loved it. Yeah, I finally loved writing. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of scared that I was making an ass of myself and not really knowing, like, are these the right, you know, is this right? Is it wrong? But yeah, it felt right for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, all those MFA questions, you know, does the conflict come close enough? Is this character's arc, like, I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot of considerations that you have to do, whether it's an MFA or, you know, a workshop you do in your community, that, like, I always hear the best advice is just, like, write for yourself, and then it almost becomes, like, you know, impossible when you're in those kind of situations. That's definitely been, I don't know about you, Liz, that's definitely been my biggest struggle with this workshop, which is just like thinking of all the people that I've now know as human beings. And I'm like, okay, so what are these six people going to think about it? And is that sentence, I don't know. That's, I mean, maybe I'm just, you know, insecure, but that's, it gets into my head a lot more than it did when I was writing before the program.
Do you feel that, Liz?
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know. It feels like the MFA is sort of like this capsule of kind of random people. I mean, that come together to, it's like for us to learn that lesson for ourselves, right? Of like, can I be as in touch with my feelings, as in touch with what is meaningful to me as a person and a writer in front of people on the page? Like, is that possible? You know, so it's kind of like, I don't know. It almost doesn't matter who they are or their personalities, or I try for it to not matter, to project too much onto these individuals. It's like, ideally it's a safe space where we can practice doing that, I think, because someday it would be nice to publish something and put a work out into the world. And it seems like you're at that place now, Avner, of like, your book is coming out into the world and it's going to be, you know, what it is to people. And I guess, I don't know, it's sort of like a personal thing too, of just like, as cheesy, but you just be as authentically yourself as you can be and in the world, and however people receive it is how they receive it. And the best stuff comes from tapping into that and getting away from, you know, what we think people will like. But it's funny too, in terms of humor, right? Because bringing it back, I don't know why, but yet again, to like making jokes, because it's like, when I write humor, it needs to be very funny to me in particular. And the stuff that is the most particular is the most universal, but like, you have to have an audience in mind. You have to like, you have to be writing to somebody, even if you're not ever sharing it with anybody, you have an audience, even if it's a fictive one. So I don't know, you know,
all my jokes are just inside jokes with me and people who don't know who I'm talking to.
But you know,
just inside jokes with you.
Yeah, it's my own internal jokes I've logged over the years.
But you know, you're funny, right? I mean, like, you know that there's certain people who, you know, who think you're funny. Right. I mean, you know, you can laugh with certain people. Like, I have, you know, two really great friends, and, you know, they're not big readers of literary fiction. But so I don't know if I'm ever thinking, well, they're, you know, will they read this and think it's funny? but I know they think that my humor is funny, or like my brother, like, you know, I love laughing with my brother, or both my brothers. I love laughing with both of them. But, you know, so again, like, I don't know if they're going to read it, but it's enough for me to know that, like, this humor, I don't know. It's, it can work. It does work with certain people.
Yeah. It's been tested, and
Yeah, it's like you have to have like people that you know are going to safely receive where you're coming from and your whole perspective and everything. But then it's like you also need to have those people, imagined or and projected or not, who just hate what you're saying and hate what your your whole life view is, and think that it's either disgusting or profane or stupid or whatever. It's like that also is kind of a necessary tension, I think, in humor and writing in life. Like, so I don't know, in terms of the MFA or in terms of publishing a book or whatever, I mean, the best stuff does get a lot of hate a lot of time, or people have strong reactions to it, you know? So it'd probably be good for us, John, if we had some like haters in the chorus or something, or like people that were.
Yeah. at least for the right reasons, like Avner, you're saying about your wife, where she's just like, that's just disgusting. You know what I mean? Like, so, like that, as opposed to like, this isn't working. But yeah, I would love to have somebody be like, this is crass and gross and you should be suspended from school. You know, that would be great. But yeah, I mean, that's interesting, just measuring against your own clock and, you know, trying not to bomb on the stage.
I think, you know, one of the things you do learn in an MFA program, at least for me, I mean, kind of touching on what you're saying, is that, and then it probably goes hand in hand with what I was saying about my own journey, quote unquote, that I was like very aware of how people would respond to my work. And, you know, I don't know, some people don't agree with this, but I do think it's a very competitive environment. And you're competing for all types of things. And I think you need to, you know, get, it's part of the same thing where people say, you know, like they go to an MFA program because this person teaches there and that person teaches there. And you're in that mindset when you start the program that you want, you know, you want that teacher to be like, you know, Avner, get over here. I'm going to work with you. Yeah. And like everyone has that in their head of like, they need to be that person. Like, we're going to get that story and we're going to send it to the New Yorker. Okay. We're going to work on it together, the two of us. And
we're going to share an agent, you know, it's all going to work out.
And you have that fantasy in the beginning, and so you're very, you know, everyone makes you anxious, and how are they going to respond to my stuff? And then part of what you're working through is you realize after a while, it's like, that's just not how it works. And then, you know, one of the great things I think about MFA programs, at least for me, is, yeah, the teachers are amazing. There were some amazing teachers, but there are also some amazing students. I mean, the people, you know, I was with were great people. I mean, they were, yeah, you have some people who don't take it all that seriously. And, you know, they wrote something like an hour before class, or they took something that they wrote like maybe in high school, and they're, and you kind of learn to ignore those people. But like the core group are really good people. They're really smart people. They want to help you the same way you want to help them. And I think you do get to that point where you finally realize that. And I don't think it's that clear cut to you at the beginning of your MFA.
I'm not there yet, Avner. Not at
all. Yeah, no. I mean, I think it does take a while. It's really stressful at the beginning.
Definitely. I'm not really like too competitive about it, but I'll open a story and I'll read the first paragraph and be like, God damn it, it's so good. Yeah.
You're like, I'm sending in first drafts and this person is sending in some polished story.
So beautiful. It's so good. I was hoping I was going to be the teacher. Yeah. Like selected by the professor to become the next whomever, but it's a healthy perspective.
Yeah.
When you were at Columbia, was Donald Antrim teaching when you were there?
So
you didn't study with him, did you?
I think it's interesting. So my second year, I think my second semester, I think he was teaching, he started teaching a workshop, but it was for first years, but then he was actually my thesis reader.
Really? Because he's one of my favorite writers.
Have you ever been in touch with him?
I'm always so envious of people that got to study with him.
Oh, have you ever? You should contact him. I'm a huge Bruce J. Friedman fan. I don't know if you've ever read his stuff, but his book Stern was also probably huge influence on my work. Great book, Stern. It's really not exhausting. It's a fantastic book. He's a fantastic writer. I was telling the writer David Besmosgus. I don't know. He came to Columbia one time, and I don't know. Kind of, he came up Bruce J. Friedman, and David Besmosgus was very, very close with Leonard Michaels. And he has actually a fantastic essay he wrote about their friendship that you could find online. And he just called him up one day, and they started this tremendous friendship that lasted years and years. And he said, "You gotta call Bruce J. Friedman. He lives right in the village. Like, just call him. You know, he's like in his 80s. He'll appreciate it. You think people are calling Bruce J. Friedman like nonstop saying?" Just call him. And I didn't. And it's such a regret of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause I think he would have, I don't know. Like, I don't know what it would have led to, but just to maybe sit and chat, whether it was for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, I don't know.
I've heard that before, even if it's just like writing a fan note is such a sweet thing, such a nice thing to do for a writer that's influenced your life, really, I mean, it's just tough because all my favorite writers are incredibly intimidating. I mean, I don't know about Donald Antrim, but like Joy Williams is my favorite writer and I would never write her a letter.
I love Joy Williams also. I love Donald Antrim as well. Yeah. But I think he's really a very sweet, nice person.
I'll write him a letter.
I know people who studied with him, after I left, and they just, adore him. But he was my thesis reader, and he told me I need to read A Dance to the Music of Time.
That whole thing, huh?
Talk about exhaust. That's an exhausting book. But he was and. I didn't get through the whole thing, but he was right. That was really, really helpful reading that. So,
you should call him, Liz. Come on out.
I'll call him when I get off the Zoom call with you guys.
just ring him up. How do you even find these people's numbers? I don't know. You'll figure it out.
It'd be cool if he was in the phone book, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But he's kind of an interesting, his books are quite slim, but I think he also, when you talk about plot and really kind of staying in the moment, he's really interesting in that way, in the sense of, I think the thing that's most fascinating about him is his use of space. He just has these The 100 Brothers and The Verifications. I mean, these like tight spaces where there's just so much action happening. Mm-hmm. And, again, he doesn't, he is aware again, I think, of plot to a certain degree, but I think he's also has that sense of who really gives a crap about plot, as long as I'm that each moment is great and I could just tack it on to the next moment, then it's gonna work. And those books work, somehow. They're brilliant.
And I guess the escalation, it's like a combination of one tremendous brilliant moment after another that escalates to like some catastrophic kind of cataclysm or something.
Liz, you turned me on to Like Mr. Robinson for a Better World, which I still haven't read yet, but need to do so.
It's super dark. Everybody always we're talking so much about humor today, but everybody's like, oh, what do you think the funniest book is? I'm like, I think it's that one. But then, not to spoil anything, but it kind of is about it's low-key about kind of like torturing children, or it has a lot to do with like medieval torture and the school for children. And so when I have to be careful what books I recommend to people, because they can be quite dark.
Don't worry. I love that stuff.
Yeah. I thought you would.
Yeah. Well, something else, Avner, that I'm super interested in is like your experience then having finished this book and like publishing? Because one of the reviews, I don't know if you identify with this group or whatever, but it was like the Bloomists or something, and it was people who published their first novel after 40.
And I
think that's cool and everything, but it feels like you, in my opinion, it feels like you just took the necessary journey to like get to where you were ready to write a great novel. And but I'm wondering, like, I guess first, like, what the publishing process was like the story about how you went and got it published. And, you know, I think a lot of people freak out, like, I'm going to turn 30 soon, right? And I'm like, oh, here's a list of 20 authors who published their first novel before 30. And it doesn't matter, right? But like, people need to get over that. So
yeah, I mean, I definitely started writing, I think, a little later than most people. Like, I didn't, you know, I'm not one of these people, like, I knew I wanted to be a writer since I was 6 or 7. I was in university, I was studying political science and American history, and I read a little fiction here and there, but I was mostly reading nonfiction, a lot of political philosophy, and I was in a class, Brazilian history, 1500 to 1950, and there were like 5 of us in the class, and it was a 4-hour lecture, and you know, the professor's just sitting there staring at you, and it's only 5 of you. So I just started writing fiction one day, and kind of just, yeah, I guess, you know, just started, and then I started reading a lot of fiction. So I kind of started late. I mean, I was in college a little later, and I think it just took me a long time to become a good writer. I mean, then I didn't start my MFA till I was like, probably like around your age, 28, 29 or so. And then the book took a long time. I mean, I started writing it, you know, close to the end of the second year. And it then took me probably 5-6 years till I got like a good solid draft. And then I made a lot of mistakes. I made a lot of horrible mistakes when it comes to publishing. I mean, really.
Well, what are some of those mistakes?
Yeah, I should tell you all.
tell them all. Get it off your chest.
Well, mistake number one was that, you know, I got to a point, I think especially after I finished I handed in my thesis, which was probably like the first half of my book. And, you know, it was I felt like, yeah, on a, you know, pretty strong pages. And, you know, I just now need to finish, write the second half of the book. And I said, you know, I'm not going to show any pages to anyone, because I very much had that workshop mentality of, you show stuff to people, they're just going to crap on it, you know, like, mm-hmm. that's how it works in workshop. And it's not like people have bad intentions. It's just, they feel like you're giving them something, you know, because that you need their help with it. So I'm like, that's just going to slow me down too much. So I really need to get to the end. So I did that. I got to the end, and then I started giving things to people, and people are like, yeah, you change this, change that. And I just got frustrated that people were reading bits and pieces, and I didn't give the whole book to just one person to read, because I felt bad like giving someone 600 pages to read. So that was mistake number one. Like, if you're going to have someone give you feedback on your novel, give them the novel. Don't just give them pages, you know, 150 to 250, because it's just going to frustrate you, and, you know, they're not going to speak to the problems that are plaguing the novel. So, and then I didn't put it away. I should have put it away for 6 months, because I was just anxious to get it out, and I kind of had these, you know, agents I was going to send it to, and I started sending it to some agents, and, just getting rejections. And then I went back to the drawing table, and really for like, I'd say 2 years or so, I really just worked on it. Like, I started like, yeah, this is not good. You know, it needs a lot of work. And so then after 2 years, I started sending it out again. And this is mistake number two. You know, I was spending so much time with agents. Again, I mean, we're talking about fantasies. You got the fantasies when you start your MFA, and you get rid of some of those fantasies, but you have a whole new set of fantasies when you get that book ready to try to get it out in the world. And you just think like, I'm going to get an agent and I'm going to get a deal with Simon & Schuster or whatever, you know. And all the agents, I got like a, you know, some were like interested, but they would be like, oh, you know, he's not likable enough. You know, he's not your protagonist isn't likable enough. I was getting that a lot. And one of my teachers is like, I feel like that's terrible. I said that to one of my teachers. I said, he's like, what's happening with the novel? And I said, I've heard from like four or five agents that it's just not likable enough. And he's like, tell them to get a dog. but you start to realize, you know, the other thing also is, so you then send it to these, you send, you know, 20 pages to an agent, and then the agent will write back like, I love these 20 pages. Can you send me the full manuscript? So you send the full manuscript, and then the agent writes back, oh, you know, thank you for sending the full manuscript. I'm so excited to read this. You probably won't hear from me for 6 to 12 months. But please let me know if another agent makes you an offer, so you know I can give you an answer. And then you see what's happening. I mean, I've never been excited to read a book and then been like, I'm so excited to read this book. I really hope to get to it in the next 6 to 12 months. Like, you know, they couldn't have been that excited to read the rest of my book. And I think you kind of start to see it's this, like, there's a lot of like, I mean, listen, I'm not saying my book was that great, but there's certainly that they need certain validation. I think there's certain agents, they need the validation. Like, did that agent say that he or she wanted it? Because if he or she wanted it, then I want it. But yeah, like I have a friend who does startups, and he says with investors, it's the same thing. It's like every investor is like, oh, I'm pretty interested in your company. If you get money, let me know so I could put some money in. But no one wants to be that first person to put the money in. And so I was getting a lot of that. And then I sent my book to Matthew Sharp to read. You know Matthew Sharp, the writer, and he read it for me. And you know, he said to me, I mean, this was going back to mistake number two. He's like, you know, I read your book and you've talked about some of your influences. And he's like, you know, why do you think this is going to be the way you do it? Like, you're going to get an agent and then you're going to get like big publishing deal. He's like, I don't think this book is like an agent, big publisher deal. He's like, go to a small publisher. That's where you're going to, you know, that's where it's going to happen for you. Then someone set up a meeting with me, connected me with this agent. And this agent calls me like a few weeks after I sent him the book. And he says to me, oh, I really would love to meet you. Can you come, you know, to the office? And I'm like, oh man, it's all happening now. I was so excited. I mean, you know, didn't sleep the night before, stressing about what I was going to wear, couldn't eat the morning of, and like my parents happened to be in town. I was like, oh my God, this is like all coming together. Like, and then I show up to the agency and like, I get there and like someone takes my coat and there just happens to be this, you know, kind of famous writer who just happens to be there. I'm like, oh man, they're laying it on thick for me, you know, like. And we sit down, and I'd say after like 10 minutes it becomes pretty clear that he only decided to meet with me because he's like, we have this mutual friend, and I think he felt obligated to the friend. But in any event, he said, you know, I like the book, it's pretty good, but there's a bunch of changes I want you to make. So we start going over the changes. And I'd say, as you probably can relate to in workshop, it becomes pretty clear when someone's not the right reader of your work. And, you know, I'm looking at this list. I'm like, bad idea, bad idea, bad idea, bad idea. But then I said, oh, wow, I don't know. This is a good idea. Like, you know, there was one scene where he's like, he thought the book was a little too dirty, But then there was one scene he thought he needed to be dirtier. It's like, oh, it was great.
You're like, oh, maybe this suggestion.
And yeah, I was like, yes. And I will say, it's probably the best note I've ever gotten. And then there was another suggestion he gave me. I had a book within the book of like the visiting writer. And he's like, you need to get rid of that. And that also really kind of spoke to me. I think it like, again, like articulated something I knew, but didn't want to admit. I was like, and then he goes, and write a synopsis of your book. And I was like, mistake number three, you know, like, how did I never done that? I think I was so opposed to the idea of outlines, and like, I saw that as being so amateur. I still think it is, like, early, like when you're doing that first draft, never write with an outline. But when you finish that first draft, definitely write an outline and definitely write a synopsis. And it's going to tell you so much about the book. And I made those changes. I wrote the synopsis and I made just a couple tweaks based on what I was seeing in the synopsis. And then I started sending the book out to small publishers, and I started getting, I could see right away, I was getting a lot more positive reactions, and yeah, and it happened. Yeah.
That's great. And so what was the, obviously it sounds kind of tedious and shitty to have to deal with like big time agents and big publishing houses. So what were some of the marked changes of like dealing with small presses, just more individual one-on-one conversations, or?
I mean, it's, you know.
Were they better readers?
There are some good agents out there. I don't want to like be like that. I mean, there's some amazing agents out there. And I think the part of the problem is just finding, I mean, again, you're chasing these agents, and then you look at their list and you're like, why would that person like my book? Like, they clearly wouldn't. It's not a good fit. I think that's hard finding, but I think with a small publisher, listen, my publisher, Jerry, who runs Tortoise, yeah, like he gets the book. He got the book right away. That was amazing for me. Like, he knew what I was after. And even in our first call, his suggestions of like, you know, why don't, you know, let's work on this, maybe change that. Again, it wasn't, I mean, were there things I disagreed with? Yeah, sure. But, you know, most of the changes really spoke to me. And yeah, it's great. I mean, I love him. I'm so just happy that I now have him as a friend and someone I can share work with and talk to about books and other things. I don't know what it's like for other people with their agents. But yeah, you know, it's a good, I like the family, the Tortoise family, the other books that they publish. I really feel like, wow, my book really kind of fits in there with these other books, which is kind of exciting. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, it seems like it's, I mean, well, congratulations. I'm happy that your book found a home. Oh, and it seems like with writing, that's so important, right? To find people that get it, people that are on the same wavelength. And I even found that with MFA programs, because I applied for 2 years before applying to NYU. And I had avoided applying to NYU because I didn't want to live in New York again. And I like had this idea that I hated New York. And it turns out it's like the perfect place, you know, with MFA programs. It's a similar thing that I had been applying as finding, I imagine, a publishing company or an agent or whoever's supportive of your writing. Like, it's about finding people that are on the same wavelength and get what you're doing and get your personality and influences and all of that. Before I didn't want to apply to NYU because I did my undergrad at Barnard and I had this idea that I hated New York City and I never wanted to go back to New York because it was like pretentious elites and it was really fucking cold and I hate the winter and I just wanted to live in Florida. So I kept applying to this MFA program in Boca Raton. And then also
Florida, Florida Atlantic.
Yeah. Florida, yeah. Florida Atlantic. Yeah. And then the one at Florida, the other University of Florida one, I guess. And when I look at the program, I'm like, well, of course they didn't accept me. This is not my tribe. Like, this is not like, at all people that would like what I was doing, which is kind of like, I don't know, my writing is like funny and a bit fucked up and also sort of spiritual, I guess, if I had to pigeonhole it. And yeah, so, you know, I just had to finally be like, I'm just going to apply to NYU and some other schools. And then NYU turned out to be the perfect place. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I'm curious, like whether, you know, I think people do sometimes get in bad situations because of that. You know, it's, they're so anxious to get with a certain agent or any publisher. And it's, you know, if it's not the right fit, it's, you know, bad things could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, it's like any relationship, like why try to make something work that isn't working or where people are not seeing eye to eye, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It is really weird how kind of things happen when they're supposed to, you know, when, I mean, I also like, I kind of think about my writing, like I'm even happy in a weird way that my book's coming out now as opposed to like a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Like, I don't know if I would have had the right frame of mind or even really thought of my book in the right way where I would have been able to make those final changes or really, you know, finish it up the way it needed to be finished up. So, yeah.
Did you ever get to a point internally where you were like, all right, this is finished and I'm like happy to send, or are you always kind of?
Well, I was at a point where I was just going to, you know, throw out the novel, you know, put it in a drawer. I mean, that before I sent it to this writer to read, I didn't know him at all. And I said to him, you know, I just don't know what to do with it. Like, do I keep trying or do I just put it in a drawer and just, you know, keep working on the next one? So I was really ready to just get rid, you know, to dump it. I was at that point. yeah
and now though you're like the necessary changes have been made and you feel real good about everything that's done. Are you ever do you ever have like nightmares where you're like, oh, I forgot this?
Yeah, I have crazy nightmares. Like we had a complete freak out. I had a complete freak out that, you know, one of like the final days, there was like this one word not very politically correct, and I was just like, I don't know. You know, it's weird. I mean, going back to what we're saying, when you're sitting and writing in a room and you're in that headspace of like the character and the book and the rhythm of it all, you're not, again, I'm not thinking anyone's ever really gonna read it. And then I'm like, you know, this is it. It was like the last couple days. I mean, we were really finishing up the final edits. And I was like, yeah, I don't know, Jerry, you know, I just really just don't feel comfortable. And he's trying to say to me, listen, that's a good sign. That's a good sign if you feel so uncomfortable. I was like, yeah, I don't know. I think just people can maybe misinterpret it. And he's like, it's, you know, it makes sense. You're not doing anything wrong. I don't remember even what we decided, but yeah.
You're like blocking
it out. But that just goes to show also what it's, you know, it's just at that point you're just manufacturing fear.
Yeah, right.
None of it really has any content.
Well, you left it in, you know, maybe Breitbart will review it positively and you'll get a whole new whole new wave of fans.
Oh god.
That's
one of the nightmares I have. like the wrong, you know, the wrong people like it.
Oh god.
That won't happen, but no, it's very understandable. But and what about Twitter? Talk about like finding your people, like writer Twitter. Like, is it good, is it bad, should we be off of it? That's how we met, right? On Twitter
I follow Liz, but Liz, you're off Twitter now. I have not seen you tweet in a long time.
I am off of Twitter, and I'm going to tell you guys, it's the best decision I've ever made in my life.
Yeah.
It is helping me so much with writing. But I have been browsing on there a bit and I'm missing out on some good stuff. I don't know. Twitter is honestly like a drug. I think it's incredibly stimulating, incredibly motivating, intoxicating, and amazing as far as websites go, although during the pandemic it's been kind of shit, but whatever. But it's like, I don't know, for me it takes up so much mental space and attention and drains me of so many emotional reservoirs that it's, I can't personally handle it, but I also can't personally handle doing drugs. So, you know, it's probably like has something to do with that. So, yeah.
Yeah. I also have a very, I have a very obsessive personality and I don't think it's great for me. I didn't do any, I was never on social media in my life. Like I never had a Facebook account. I never had Twitter, you know, nothing. And then like my publisher is like, dude, you gotta, like, we have to sell some books, you know, like, so I went on everything and, you know, I mean, Facebook is just the worst, like it's really just awful.
Yeah.
Horrible. I don't even have it, which I pride myself on. I got off many years ago, but it's awful.
The Twitter's interesting because, I mean, Twitter's also pretty awful in many, many ways. It's very high schoolish, which I really, especially like I really like book Twitter in a way, or literary Twitter, whatever one wants to call it. Like there are amazing things about it. I have met some incredible people. I've been exposed to some amazing writing, amazing writers. And for that, I would think maybe it's worth it. But then there's like a whole other side, which is so awful. And it goes back to, you know, I think people like us, probably we probably hold our tongues. We probably don't say what we really think about things because it's really vicious. And there's a whole class of people, writers, that get away with saying whatever they want and being somewhat nasty to people. And I'm not excusing the nastiness, but even I would say even not nastiness, but even just strong opinions that are perfectly legitimate opinions and that are maybe even good things to be talking about, you know, whether, you know, disagreement about a book or whatever. And then some people who just, they get, you know, they say one thing and they just get attacked. And so when you're like us, you know, we don't have that stature. Like you just stay quiet. And then that makes it really boring. Like you're just, it just makes it boring. I mean, and kind of pathetic. Like I was thinking the other day of like I was looking at my kids and I was thinking, what if when I was a kid, I was looking at my parents when they were like my age, like in their, you know, 43. And I was looking at my dad and just sitting there and like trying to come up with the perfect tweet and like, and he'd be like chasing likes. I'd be like, my dad is the saddest sack in the world. Like, like a grown man chasing likes. Like, it's, you know, it's pathetic. And then I started to think, well, maybe it would have been good. Like, maybe it would have been like a good outlet for him, or maybe kind of would have made him would have been a good social outlet for him. I don't know.
There was a point in the beginning, I just got on Twitter pretty recently. There was a point in the beginning where I felt like it had that social community aspect. Like I work a boring, unrelated full-time job. It's not related to writing, so I don't really run into the writers so much. So I kind of initially I thought, yeah, this is like a cafe in Paris in the 40s, 30s where everybody hangs out and this is going to be cool. Like great ideas are going to be here.
Yeah. And then they're like, I mean, they're, you know, like well-established writers who will literally tweet book, you know, books are life, and they'll get like 900 likes or something.
I love
400
books.
Tweets. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, you know, I can come up with the writing, greatest.
Writing is hard, you know.
Yeah. Writing is hard. Be kind to yourself. 3.5 million likes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's tough.
Yeah.
I will say, I mean, Twitter taught me how to write sentences to some extent. Like you have to, I don't know. There's so many good things about it and so many just fucking terrible things about it. But the good things are good. For me, it's just that it's very like, it's very addictive and it ruins my attention. So, you know, writing fiction takes sustained attention and thoughts that develop over time. And I have to let them like sit in my subconscious mind and, you know, just like rest for a bit. And Twitter is like this constant stimulation that doesn't really go to like a deeper level and doesn't allow me to think about something in a substantive way. So, you know.
Yeah. And just like discrete, completely separate ideas, one second after the other, where you're just like, here's a thing about whatever. And you're like, there's no train of thought that you can get on. It's just,
I also feel it is like maybe a certain element of it. And I don't want to paint with a broad brush here, but it's almost like the worst, well, there's a lot of bad, but some of the worst elements of kind of Silicon Valley consumerist culture have infected, you know, literary Twitter with like this like need for constant self-promotion and like the need for like a content, like a lot of people start seeing themselves as content creators, like you know, how many acceptances they got, where, you know, all their stuff. And I mean, I get it, you know, we all want to promote our stuff. I'm going to be promoting my stuff, so I'm like no different. But
sometimes, yeah, man, Jerry needs you on Twitter. You know, you've got to get out. Yeah.
Sometimes it just really starts, you know, just being over. It's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I've read some incredible stuff that I wouldn't have read, or met some incredible writers and been exposed to their work. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And it's good. It's good for promoting. I mean, I think maybe things will change. Who knows? Like, social media is shifting in weird ways nowadays. But, like, it is good, you know, especially since you have your book coming out, yeah. And if, you know, we start publishing, John, it's like, it probably is good for us to have it, yeah. And a necessary thing that people tell you to have. So, mm-hmm.
I mean, I think everyone also just sort of needs help, like writers, agents, publishers. And when you bring in 10,000 followers to a business relationship, they're probably excited about it, you know, but
right.
Yeah.
Right now I've got my family and a couple of close friends, and that's all I can offer the future publisher.
You guys, I have to run.
I think we've taken
the time.
I think we've taken more of your time than we promised.
This was fun. I didn't even see that we've been on for so long. It's great.
It was great. It was awesome to meet you, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, best of luck to the two of you. I hope, can't wait to read your stuff soon, whenever.
Yeah, thank you for coming to chat with us. And it's so funny in our discussion of, you know, how much Twitter sucks, it's like we met through Twitter.
Yeah,
and I'm
exactly.
So grateful that we did and that you came on and we got to chat. So
for sure. Yeah,
well we're definitely anticipating the release of the book. So
awesome, thank you so much. So will I. I'm gonna be promoting it like crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Googling what is SEO, how does SEO work. Anyway, congratulations, and it's awesome. Hope you stay healthy and safe.
Likewise.
Thanks so much.
Enjoy the program. Thanks again for having me.
We hope you enjoyed our discussion with Avner. Again, I can't recommend Meiselman in the Lean Years highly enough. I think you'll enjoy it, so stay tuned for that release. I hope you guys have a good week. Got a few exciting episodes coming up. Stay tuned for those as well. Really appreciate some of the feedback we've been getting, some of your comments, and the love expressed for certain episodes really makes me quite happy. So keep it coming, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.